1967 was a busy year for the Beatles, arguably their most productive and creative. Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane, All You Need Is Love, Hello Goodbye, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The climax of the year was the transmission on BBC television of a film made by the Beatles, Magical Mystery Tour. The story of Magical Mystery Tour has never been told. After it was shown on Boxing Day 1967, all hell broke loose. A bottle floating forwards on misty water. Inside it, pink neon letters spell out the word Arena. Old film of a well-dressed, excited audience sitting on the floor. Magical Mystery Tour revisited. The audience get to their feet.
End number, that was Wild Track, applause, clapping and all the rest of it. Cut.
This film contains outtakes as well as original scenes from Magical Mystery Tour. A clip from LSD, 24 Hours, BBC Television.
I haven't seen cover. I live in a monochromatic world. I can't use cover.
The young woman shakes her head.
I can do everything.
What do you mean by everything?
Everything. Everything's... it was shape before, but now it's colour.
The 14-hour Technicolor Dream, Alexandra Palace, 29th April, 1967. 1967 was the summer of love. The Beatles made the album that defined it. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was released in June. It was number one for the next 6 months. Then they decided to make Magical Mystery Tour. A tour guide in a white uniform on a coach.
If you look to your left, ladies and gentlemen, the view is not very inspiring. But if you look to your right...
The grass, the mountains, everything's neon green. Sir Paul McCartney.
We didn't really want to do something that didn't represent where we were up to. However, people didn't know where we were up to. And it wasn't the kind of thing we could say, do a disclaimer before and say, ladies and gentlemen, what you're about to see is the product of our imaginations. And believe me, at this point, they're quite vivid. You couldn't do that. You know, you just have to be, here it is.
On the Magical Mystery Tour bus.
Who is that man?
Magical Mystery Tour features a collection of eccentric characters. On a coach trip to an unspecified destination. Some were played by professional actors. Some were simply people invited along for the ride. The Beatles themselves were loosely in character. Ringo Starr watches himself.
Anyway, I'll tell you something. You ain't coming away with me anymore.
Who bought the ticket for this trip? I did.
Yeah, with my mother.
I bought it.
You're
not taking me
anywhere. Ringo was given a central role.
Oh, isn't he lovely? Look at him. He's got such pep and life. Look, look at him. It's Ringo, one of the Beatles. He's marvellous.
Wow, those fellas.
Oh, he's smashing. He plays them drums. He goes out and he earns five bob. Not like
Listen,
you.
Listen, I've heard a few stories about those boys.
I don't care what you've heard. They're smashers and you shut up. If you learn to play the drums, you could earn an extra five bob.
I'm not doing so bad, am I?
Doing so bad? You're as skint as armholes every week. What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with you? You've moaned ever since we got on this bus.
Well, I promised your father I'd take you. I'm dead sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. I can't believe it.
Just ad lib. I mean, there's no script.
What, looking at the mini?
We thought we could have something running through it all the while. And it was me and her. And we were always arguing.
What's the matter with you?
And it sort of got us from one place to the next.
This picture probably reflects their state of mind more than anything else they had done at the time. That's the way they perceived the world around them.
Martin Scorsese, director.
For me, the freedom of the picture was something that was very, very important. The sense of breaking all the form. Obviously, some of it I didn't quite understand in terms of the humor, but it's the way it was in those days. I mean, people were trying everything, and whether it fully succeeded or not was really beside the point.
In Scotland and Northern Ireland, there'll be slight frost leading to icy patches on roads around dawn. Afternoon temperatures will range from 5 degrees centigrade, 41 Fahrenheit in northern Scotland, to about 8 degrees centigrade, 46 Fahrenheit in southern England.
Magical Mystery Tour was going to be a highlight of the BBC Christmas schedule.
The Val Doonigan Show. Top of the Pops.
Photos of each of the Beatles and Dusty Springfield.
These are just some of the BBC One programmes this Christmas.
The film was due to go out on Boxing Day between the Petula Clark Christmas special and a Norman Wisdom movie.
In my family, Boxing Day was more often the party day, really. Lots of relatives around.
Aunties and uncles and my sisters and brothers would have all been over, having had their Christmas at home together and then over to us on the Boxing Day.
It was tradition for us to go into the neighbour's house on Boxing Day. And we used to play Monopoly in the afternoon. And I was always allowed a snowball with apricot and lemonade in. That was my treat.
The Christmas schedule is always one of these difficult things to get together. And on that particular year, in 1967, I had a gap on Boxing Day. And suddenly I got to hear of this film, The Magical Mystery Tour. It was described to me as a film made by the Beatles, containing the Beatles, and containing a lot of music. And that, as far as I was concerned, was good enough.
At 8:35pm, a quarter of the population sat down to watch Magical Mystery Tour on BBC One in black and white.
Sitting in front of the television, very, very close to the screen. No clue who was in the room with me, apart from my dad, because he seriously didn't like the Beatles. And he spent most of his time grunting and saying it was a load of rubbish. Why don't you turn it over and why don't you talk to the visitors because we've got guests?
My dad said, they should get their hair cut. And I said, Dad, you know Jesus had long hair, don't you? And he just didn't know what to say.
My parents didn't like it. My dad thought it was rubbish. And I'm pretty sure he turned it off before the end.
I loved it. It was a great movie to see the Beatles doing something different as wizards and all that sort of thing.
I was 15 years old. I remember we sat and we watched it right the way through in silence. And afterwards, we just looked at each other and we said, what was all that about? That was the beginning of the end of their innocence to me and my innocence.
The film caused outrage. Paul McCartney went on the Frost programme to defend it.
I liked it, with reservations and so on, but I mean, why were people so puzzled by it, do you think?
I think they thought it was bitty, which it was a bit, you know, but it was supposed to be like that. I think a lot of people were looking for a plot, and there wasn't one.
I think the younger people would get it, people who knew what was going on in society, would get it, and the older people who were expecting Morecambe and Wise or a British variety show wouldn't get it, and I think, in a way, quite rightly, would be annoyed. It's like they'd been cheated out of the Christmas special.
There was, it seemed, very little magic about this particular mystery tour, most reporting viewers, in fact, finding it virtually incomprehensible. There was no theme or storyline, they complained. The programme appearing to consist of confused, disconnected shots of the weirdest things and suggesting a nightmare rather than a mystery tour. The following are just a few of the many outraged comments.
The biggest waste of money since the groundnut scheme.
Positively the worst programme I can remember seeing on any TV channel.
The small minority who did enjoy the programme hailed it as something completely different. A schoolboy had this to say. It was one of the best Christmas programmes we have had for a long time. The idea was clever as well as original. It was very funny in parts. A marvellous programme in black and white, In colour, it would be indescribable.
Paul Merton, comedian and broadcaster.
When they first toured, they were touring with comedians and singers and stuff, and it was part of a showbiz package deal, you know. So that was, what, 63 they were doing that. So in the space of 4 years, which is nothing, we're in the world of Sgt. Pepper and caftans and incense and San Francisco and all that kind of thing. So I should imagine some members of the establishment were rather sort of... perturbed, because it looked to them like the Beatles had gone from being take that to take this or something, you know?
The entire nation had been let down by the Beatles.
They hated it. At least the people who wrote in the newspaper hated it. You know, they... don't forget that with all the success we'd had, every time something came out, a new record or whatever, they'd all try and slam it so that, you know, because once they've built you up that high, you know, all they can do is knock you back down again. I mean, that's what happens. That's life. So they really didn't like it, but it's understandable too, because it wasn't a brilliant scripted thing that was executed well. It was like a little home movie, really, an elaborate home movie.
I don't know. I should never have brought you.
Look, there's really no pleasure for me either. There really isn't. I've had the worst time of my life here.
Worst time of your life?
Worst time of my life. It's the draggiest tour I've been on with you.
Good God, I don't know.
And it won't happen again.
The
it's
more
the last time
I've
met you
out.
Want.
The more they
you
want.
You come round to our house moaning and groaning. You've nothing to do. I take pity on you. Come on, I'll take you,
you
on this tour.
You take pity on me and I have to pay right. for you. Oh, yes, very
well,
good.
Well, that's fair.
Lovely
I'm
nephew.
I'm taking you out, aren't I?
You're a beautiful nephew. Yes,
anyway,
you are.
Just behave, will you? There's a lot
what
of nice
behave?
People on this coach and they're all looking at us.
I shall have to smack you down any minute. Don't you talk to your auntie
you
like that.
Don't you smack me down, Mrs.
Don't talk to auntie
don't
like
you
that.
Smack me!
Now shut up!
Please!
It's Paul's idea, really. We were hanging out in the studio, you know, looking for stuff to do, really. And he came up with this idea. He said, look, I've got this idea.
A circle on a piece of paper.
And we said, great. And it actually moved from that circle to this, to this. Then you can cut in the movie.
When a man buys a ticket for a magical mystery tour, he knows what to expect. We guarantee him the trip of a lifetime, and that's just what he gets. The incredible magical mystery tour.
George Harrison.
It was basically a charabang trip, which people used to go on from Liverpool to see the Blackpool lights, and they'd get, you know, loads of crates of beer and an accordion player and all get pissed.
Passengers singing on the coach at night.
All the coach trips I went on to Blackpool, the lights were very fuzzy. But that's another story.
Black and white film of the lights of Blackpool. Paul's pie chart of the film. Then Paul trotting and stomping alongside a sun-dappled sea.
Any company over the Dolans? Any company over the Dolans? Any company over the Dolans? Any
The third section of the film has passengers running a marathon. Then in the fifth, dreams, there's a surreal scene in a restaurant.
This time I mean it! I can't breathe anymore.
In the sixth section of the film, the Beatles are playing in animal masks and white fur gilets. The next section is labelled Stripper Plus Band.
Can kill.
A woman takes off her jacket and wafts a pink feather boa around. Paul Gambaccini, broadcaster.
The part of Magical Mystery Tour that I didn't get, and which I knew Americans would also not get, were the things that were very English. For example, the concept of a mystery tour. America didn't have it. You had to know where you were going before you got onto a bus. It's a very English concept that you have old dears that you like to be around no matter how hip you are, and that you have extended family that you're not embarrassed by. And the people on that coach were old dears and extended family. So it just seemed like a very odd thing for the Beatles to want to do. The Beatles were cultural mission control. They were where it was at. Culture was them, they were culture. Why are they hanging around with fat old women? There's nothing against fat old women, but I'm talking about the prejudices of the time of the people who would be watching. I don't think Americans would have gotten it.
It was made like an art film. The small narrative of the bus just sort of held it together again. But again, you know, you weren't supposed to know where it was going.
Neil Innes, musician. The Beatles wave from a skylight in the roof of the bus.
67, August, I arrived. I thought it was kind of a dream come true, because it was like a gigantic, the part that I was focused on was a gigantic costume ball, it seemed to me. People were just, you know, dressed outrageously, beautifully.
I want to do some breeches. Some velvet breeches, yeah, down to the knee, but with buttons from about there upwards, down there.
What is this thing you've got here today?
This button, that's a button, it's green. And it says go.
Green.
Yeah, you can see it, but it means go. Instead of, you know, all the other buttons that people wear that say got messages on them, this one just says go ahead, because it's green.
What I loved was the contrast between the new generation and the music world and bowler-hatted, pinstriped city gents. Everything seemed to be nicely defined, which, of course, for an American, was fresh, because America, everything is supposed to be equal, so people camouflaged the differences. In England, it was very clear what the differences were.
Thing is, in the 60s, Britain was still very straight. It was the one British way of life. Businessmen still wore bowler hats and carried furled umbrellas, and if you deviated only quite slightly from how you were supposed to behave, then you were very much frowned upon.
Barry Miles, author and publisher of International Times.
I mean, this is still the period when they used to lock up children's swings on Sundays. You're talking about a very repressive, admittedly very benign, but still a very repressive society.
Black and white film of women in a typing pool. Old men sitting in the park, then a woman wearing a headscarf running across a road.
I mean, I had a guy, and he came to paint on my wall of the extension. His idea of the creation. And anyway, he went on, suddenly he's in the windows, he's all over the place. But anyway, I come down, he's a little hippie guy. And I see this guy, and he's in the kitchen, and he's got a suit and tie. I said, what happened? He said, oh, I'm going home. Flower power hasn't reached Leeds.
Black and white film of people going about their everyday business on a London street. Then a man holding a banner proclaiming, pot is fun. He holds it up to a double-decker bus, and the people travelling on it just stare at him. Barry Miles.
The London sort of underground culture was really just a few hundred people probably at the centre, and then maybe a few thousand altogether. There were an awful lot of people who just used the sort of 60s ideas just to have fun. I mean, it was a hedonistic movement very much. I mean, it wasn't a political movement in any of the normal senses of the word. Most of it was to do with hanging out on the King's Road and wearing frilly clothes and taking a lot of drugs and having a lot of sex, basically.
In London, it's still embryonic. The scene hasn't got very far at all. In Amsterdam, it's reached very large proportions. It's becoming a very big force there, and people are getting worried by it, the older generation. But of course, the answer they have is perfect. The young people there are quite prepared to wait for the older generation to die off.
Barry Miles, interviewed in 1967.
This is Alexandra Palace, the People's Palace, or Ali Pali as it's known to everyone. And in the summer of 1967, we had a big benefit here for International Times, which we called the 14-hour Technicolor Dream.
Black and white film taken sliding down a helter-skelter, then people milling around.
It was because International Times had been busted for obscenity, and we really thought that we had a big, big court case on our hands and needed to raise money. And 42 different bands and performance acts offered their services, all for free.
A band on stage, then people dancing with spotlights trained on some of them.
Of course, a huge number of people used it as an excuse to take acid, which was nice in a way, because it's a beautiful location. You know, the grounds here are absolutely gorgeous.
A man dancing uninhibitedly, John Lennon, then a woman in her underwear. Cut piece, created by Yoko Ono.
I really wish the people that look with anger at the weirdos, at the happenings, at the psychedelic freakout, would instead of just looking with anger, just look with nothing and with no feeling, you know, be unbiased about it. Because they really don't realize that what these people are talking about is something that they really want themselves. It's something that everyone wants. You know, it's personal freedom to be able to talk and be able to say things. And it's dead straight. It's a real sort of basic pleasure for everyone. But it looks weird from the outside.
Paul McCartney in 1967.
So this is the original premises of Indica Books and Gallery, which was started by Peter Asher, John Dunbar and myself back in 1965. And it had a lot of very close Beatles connections. Paul McCartney, for instance, helped put up the shelves and paint the walls and was very good at filling in holes in concrete.
All of this gang of people from International Times, Indica and the whole scene, you know, is trying to do, is trying to see where we are now. You know, it's just a straightforward endeavor kind of thing, you know, just to do something.
Yeah.
Other than what's been done before, because what's been done before isn't necessarily the answer.
John Lennon, of course, famously met Yoko Ono here when we gave her her very first show in Europe. In addition to that, we used to have a big settee when it was a bookshop on the ground floor. And that's where John Lennon first encountered the work of Timothy Leary. And in Leary's rewriting of the Tibetan Book of the Dead is where he found the line, turn off your mind and drift downstream.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream.
Black and white film of John Lennon. Robert Fraser, interviewed in 1967.
People like Andy Warhol are trying to integrate themselves with a commercial world, to become a part of it, but also to do what they want to do. This is what the a breakthrough is.
So here we are in Duke Street, and at number 69 is where Robert Fraser had his celebrated gallery in the late 60s. He introduced them to a lot of artists and people surrounding that sort of Hollywood and New York art scene. People like Andy Warhol, Klaus Oldenburg.
This is the story of your lives, the old dreams, the left placentas of the...
I had a period of a few years when I was living in London and I wasn't married like the other guys. They were living outside of London. So I would kind of probably see more cinema, see more theatre, go to more events just because I was there. And one of the things that I got was a Super 8 camera, which started off just doing snapshots, doing your home movies if you go on holiday. But then I got more and more interested in it, and I found one that you could rewind, so you could then go through again. I did a film that I wish I had now, which was out of my hotel window in Paris. I filmed a gendarme on traffic duty, and he's just stopping all the cars. So that was one roll through. And then the second time, he'd gone. So I then just filmed all the traffic. So it looked like this impossible job where the traffic was just going through him all the time, which was nice enough for 10 minutes. It was amusing enough for me. But then the nice thing was I found a soundtrack with a jazz saxophonist called Albert Ayler, who did a wonky version of the Marseillaise. So while this guy is, oh, no, 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 monsieur. Oh, la, la, la. You hear this. Yeah, I was doing a lot of that. And I think that was part of why I wanted to do Magical Mystery Tour.
Cine film of a man skulking along a pavement wearing an eye mask and acting oddly with a walking stick. He places the stick flat on the ground, then sets a bottle down next to it. Now, colour film of a young Paul McCartney, naked from the chest up and staring into space with brown doe eyes.
McCartney always had his antenna out. So those would be the avant-garde kind of things he'd do, but he would also go to the various sort of nightclubs and hear torch singers, and he used those extra words, that he always had his antenna out, and stuff would go in, and it might not come out for years and years.
Later, during a flaming Riviera sunset by AMM.
I went with him, for instance, to a concert by AMM, which was a sound band in which there was no noticeable rhythm or melody or anything like that. And McCartney, after a while, started to join in. He banged on the radiators and stuff like that. And it was only a small group, about 10 people in the audience. You know, it was one of those sitting on the floor in at the Royal College of Art sort of gigs.
They've got all these rules for everything, rules of how to live, how to paint, how to make music. And it's just not true anymore, you know. They don't work all those rules.
I think what happened with the Beatles is we always thought, oh, the people back home would love to know this. So we felt like we were the megaphone. So if it was happening to us and we liked it, we thought we should let them know. Because they're not here down here hanging out with the artists, but it'd be good to pass on the good news.
It was a 50-50 thing. They were influenced by what was going on in the underground, but they themselves, by taking some of those ideas on board, spread the ideas so rapidly and so quickly through their fame that they became sort of leaders of it in a curious way.
A montage of colour film of the Beatles and women and musicians of the time. Next, black and white film of a sign saying Wilshire Boulevard, an advertising hoarding and wide American freeways. The American counterculture developed on parallel lines to the UK. It took the Beatles as its leaders. 2 years earlier, on tour in California, their publicist Derek Taylor invited Peter Fonda and the Byrds to hang out with them.
I was going there and I'd asked Derek, is there anything I can bring? With the emphasis on anything. Obviously pot, I was thinking maybe. And he said, no, 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 we have everything. So I arrived, and there's Cross and McGuinn, and I was introduced to the lads. And then they announced that we were all going to take LSD. I thought, far out. I wonder how I'm going to drive this car home. I assumed that it was the first time that they all had taken acid. It wasn't my first time. I doubt it was Crosby and McGuinn's first time either. No, I know it wasn't their first time, but for the boys, I don't know.
Peter Fonda, actor and director.
I know what it's like to be dead.
Old film of female Beatles fans collapsing and having to be carried out of crowds.
And she's making me feel like I've never been wrong.
Women are tended to on the ground. Excerpts from the film Vivian by Bruce Conner, 1964.
Some beautiful underground stuff was happening, but it was underground. And we needed to get above ground.
The black and white film shows a young woman with dark hair sitting on a bed.
I was already a tremendous fan of Bruce Conner. He had a style of editing that was very influential on me as a shooter and as an editor and as a performer. Because I spent a lot of time with him looking at his films.
Just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art.
We had our own art. We had our own poetry, our own music and songs, lyrics. We had our own books. We had our own costumes. We had our own music, everything. We had all these, we don't have our own film.
Paul and Brian were sitting on the big settee, very long red settee, similar to this, and they had a number of papers in front of them. Particularly Epstein had a pie chart, and they were already planning who would do what in a film.
The name Brian Epstein was synonymous with the Beatles. He had been their manager since their first success.
Epstein was delighted, of course, because they were, you know, they just finished a major album. They were no longer touring. He hadn't really got a great deal to do. And he was quite clearly very, very enthusiastic about the whole thing.
A headline reads, Epstein dies at 32. In August 1967, Brian Epstein died of a drugs overdose.
He was just a beautiful fella, you know, and it's terrible.
What are your plans now?
Well, we haven't made any. I mean, we only just heard, haven't we?
Yes, it's...
Epstein had a little office in an ultra-modern building with a parking space underneath it. And they were all in there. I didn't know what the hell it was all about. And they said to me, we've said to Epstein, we want to make this film. And I think now they thought that now that he was dead, they would go ahead. They wanted to go ahead and make it anyway. And this was an important sort of genuflection to the work that they had done with Brian. And they did try at that point to express they wanted to be free and easy and not be constricted by the studio system and the things that were in it. They had the opportunity and the money to do something that nobody else would have been able to do. And therefore, it is a unique piece of filmmaking. You could almost call it a vanity, like a vanity publication of what they were doing, but it was more than that.
The Beatles set about deciding who they wanted on the bus. Ivor Cutler, Late Night Lineup, BBC Television, 1966.
Walking down a very narrow alley in the street, I saw an old man standing by a wall. Hastily I ran up to the old man, and I said to him in phrases very small, get away from the wall, get away from the wall, get away from the wall.
Ivor Cutler we knew, of course, because he had those great records. I'm sure somebody saw Nat Jackley was his name, you know, on a show or something.
This is Music Hall, BBC Television, 1966. Old footage of Paul McCartney and Nat Jackley in costume. Now Victor Spinetti as the recruiting sergeant.
The other thing we used to do at night, we'd go through the artists need workbooks and we, oh yeah, he looks good, or oh yeah, look at that person, and we'd just pick him out the book.
Okay. Oh, oh baby, you made me love you.
Jesse Robbins, who played Ringo's Auntie Jesse. Accordionist Shirley Evans. She smiles and jigs up and down as she plays the accordion. And Derek Royal, who played Jolly Jimmy Johnson. George Claydon, a dwarf who played a photographer. He emerges from beneath the black material of an old-fashioned camera wearing a lion's head. Then he waves. Now Mandy Wheat, who played the tour hostess, Wendy Winters.
Good morning, lads and lasses. My name is Miss Winters.
I just wanted to say, if there's anything I can do to be of assistance,
well, you know what to do.
I think what happened with the Beatles was, if you were around, you were on the bus. You know, if you'd been wherever the bus set off from that day and they thought you were all right, you'd have been on the bus.
Would you like to come on a coach trip with the Beatles?
They're making a film.
They're making a film, that's it. And that's all we knew.
Yeah.
I think I had 2 days.
Yeah.
2 days' notice.
We got on the Friday and we had to go on the Monday.
Nobody would have believed them as they told me.
I'd left my job on the Friday and I didn't go back on the Monday and I did lose it, but it was worth it.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, well, I don't know the rest of the words.
What's the
word?
Jamaican
la-la-la, darling. Yeah, just sing it if you don't know the word. Are we on?
Yeah.
Oh, yesterday.
Do you like your old auntie, darling?
Oh, you're all right. You're one of the best. All my troubles seem so far away.
What are you talking about?
That bus was hysterical. You know, all the people on the bus did. Whoa. You know, what a great thought. That's
an invitation. There was something very musical, very dance-like about the editing of the Magical Mystery Tour number in the bus. Freedom of the camera, along with the restraint of the characters looking towards the lens. For me, this has always stayed, and it's one of my favorite moments in movies. And that stayed with me over the years, and I think it's actually, looking back at it, has influenced a lot of the work I've done.
The coach left London on September the 11th, 1967, and headed off for the West Country.
Listen, this film...
Oh, yeah.
Tell us something about the storyline.
Well, you see, it's about a group of Covent Garden strange people on a coach tour around anywhere, really. And things happen to them, you see. Something got gobbly, diddly-diddly, Magical Mystery Tour. And there's a little scene.
You got them!
I've got what?
You got them on your head!
Oh, where are they? Do you want to knock them off?
Yeah.
Go on. Hello, Charlie, how are you? Got lucky.
It was lovely to see John being so comfortable in playing with this little girl. But it's a side of John that you never really saw.
He's lying down again, he did.
Put it on your hand. No.
And I must say, I don't think I'd really seen it much to that point.
You put it on your
hand. All right, I'll put it on my hand.
The Yellow Tour Bus.
I'd love to say there was, like, this incredible master plan, but... there wasn't.
We thought it might be a good idea to go towards Cornwall, where I think we'd had fond childhood memories. I'd hitchhiked down there when I was a kid. George and I had done that.
I don't think we ever really were told the reasoning behind much of it. It was just, this is going to happen, and so-and-so is going to be doing this, and so-and-so is going to be doing that, and we just did it.
Yeah.
To be honest, it was spontaneous, I think is the word.
Yes.
Spontaneous.
That's a very good word, yeah.
Cine film of Ringo Starr and the little girl from the bus playing football in a field.
Didn't have time to think about it because it was all sort of happening, but then if you analyse what was happening, you really didn't know anyway, did you? Couldn't really put your finger on what was happening.
All the passengers from the coach are heading across the field.
Paul always had a tremendous interest in spontaneity and random events and effects. A very 60s thing, of course, but random, in his sense, would be an accidental trick of the light or a superimposition.
Paul McCartney spinning around on the top of a mountain with swaying film of the mountain superimposed on top of him. Spotlight Southwest, BBC Television, 1967.
How do you frankly feel about all the reporters and all the rest of us following you around everywhere you go?
It's okay, can't be helped.
You don't mind us?
Well...
we don't get on your nerves?
No, you're not all that bad.
What's the film going to be all about?
It's a mystery to me.
Keep back, please. Keep back, filming. We're filming.
What one could see very clearly were the sequences. But how the sequences related to each other, how they juxtaposed themselves in terms of an overall story, I could never see.
Michael Saracen, cameraman.
It was almost like improvisation where everybody gets into the groove and then they start expanding on that. And to be honest with you, I don't even remember if they mimed to playback. I guess they did. Actually, they must have. Yeah, because all of a sudden I remember the first time the sound guy testing, and you hear one of the tracks booming out across the Kent countryside. It was amazing. And everybody's like galvanised, the energy that the music gave them.
As the Beatles play in their animal masks and white fur gilets, four policemen hold hands on a wall behind them.
Already there was abstract qualities in their humour and their writing and their approach to all sorts of stuff. And I think the film was a sort of natural progression or came out of that culture.
A rabbit face mask.
Oh, it was brilliant. I did. I just thought it was like anarchic.
Ringo Starr drumming in a parrot mask, then George Harrison tapping his foot.
When we were doing, it was the walrus scene or somewhere like that. Paul got me up about 2 a.m. He said, we want 12 midget wrestlers for tomorrow. Dozen midgets, you know. I said, how the hell do I get 12 midgets down here, time to shoot tomorrow morning? He said, I don't know. I mean, it was worse than the Hollywood system, you know, because Hollywood had real power. And that's what I did, and they were produced.
Four of the midget wrestlers filmed in the sunshine.
The sequences were just suggested, often by memories from our childhood. Things that we'd remembered or we remembered seeing or doing ourselves.
Action! Okay, go!
So, for instance, Tug of War was something you'd see at all the village fetes. There'd often be a tug of war between the burly men of the neighbourhood. So a lot of these things found their way in as ideas. I suppose the whole film has a bit of a village fete atmosphere to it.
It's all their childhood memories all being jumbled up and juxtaposed and coming out as a series of fairly surreal images.
Don't get upset. Don't expect something other than the Beatles. If you expect the Beatles, you're getting them. Full force. They are really there, much more than they were in Help, and much more than they were in A Hard Day's Night. They were really there because it was all their thing. They were shooting. They were deciding what to say, what to wear, how to do this. It was, in that way, it was a magical mystery tour of them.
George Harrison playing his guitar in a tailored floral jacket, then all four Beatles in psychedelic clothes, beating time to the music. John Lennon in multicolored clothes walks off from his piano. A burning orb shoots down from the sky and lands in a field. Now the passengers are queuing up in a fish and chip shop.
It seems to me now that Magical Mystery Tour is an attempt to fuse those elements of quintessential Englishness which made the Beatles feel like the people they were, with the advanced psychedelic elements that they had introduced into the culture. It's a graft.
George Harrison singing cross-legged in an orange suit.
Well, shooting Blue Jay Way was great. George had written that song because he stayed on Blue Jay Way in America. And I was just always interested in cameras and lenses. And I had all those prism lenses and close-up macro lenses and things. And so it sort of went with it. I'll bring me cameras. and you'll sit over there and, you know, it'll be smoky or whatever, and I'll just shoot it through these. And in those days, thanks to some medication, it was the most exciting thing we'd ever seen.
Psychedelic flowers superimposed on George Harrison's hands.
I think you can really feel the influence of the avant-garde cinema at the time. They all took their own home movies, etc., and they were always experimenting with this imagery. And so it seemed natural that they would try to create something that was certainly not the traditional narrative that they had worked with in the Richard Lester films, which are quite wonderful, but in a very, very different way. Almost like making their own movie paintings, music pieces, dance pieces. And it wasn't cinema, it was something else.
There was always good songs. There was a couple of good songs, and there was a few funny scenes. I mean, the scene that to me that stands out is the one of John shoveling the spaghetti onto the fat woman's plate. I mean, that was the best bit of the movie for me.
Paul showed me what his idea was, and this is how it went. It went around like this, the story, and he had it all, you know, I think, production. And he says, well, here's the segment, you write a little piece for that. And I thought, fucking hell, I've never made a film. What do you mean? He said, write a script. So, you know, I ran off and wrote the dream sequence for the fat woman and all the thing with the spaghetti and all that.
Action!
John and Paul basically would put their heads together and come back and they say, all right, this is what we want to do tomorrow. Something as simple as, you know, half a ton of spaghetti. And you have to get George Cook out of bed and say, George, you know, the first thing you do is send your buyer down and get as much spaghetti as there is.
I do remember watching John on rehearsal or whatever, and the pleasure he got from like a kid playing with mud, like slopping out all his spaghetti on that woman.
An old man smoking at a table. Then Shirley's Wild Accordion by Lennon and McCartney. Shirley Evans plays behind a screen as two young girls walk past. Annie Nightingale.
I mean, there are bits of it that's silly and a bit self-indulgent, but on the other hand, it's not pretentious. I don't think they ever were. They always managed to keep the right side of that line. And where you had Paul wanting to reflect his background, John would come along, literally span it in the works and give it that edge and made it sinister. And bits of Magical Mystery Tour are actually quite frightening and quite scary. And that's John.
I can hardly get my breath.
It's in cake, Jessie, not out cooked.
I am already. Three times this week already.
For goodness sake, Jessie, sit down. Remember.
When you talk about Buñuel, everyone was so shocked to see that shot of him apparently cutting an eye.
From Buñuel's Un Chien Andalou.
And I remember how shocking it was to see that. Now you look back on it and go, that was a very important thing in the history of cinema. You probably couldn't have had Psycho without that. And that's a nice thing that happens with these things. I mean, I don't want to elevate Magical Mystery Tour to the great heights of, you know, most important things in cinema history. But I think, in a lesser way, it did set a tone that then people could pick up and sort of say, oh, well, if they've done that, we could do this.
Nat Jackley walks up some steps carrying two cases. Paul Merton.
It's not worrying too much about your public image at that point, I think. I think it's about what you want to do. Here's an opportunity to make a film. What do you want to put in this film? What scene do you want to do? So I admire it from that point of view.
Ladies and gentlemen, when the coach stops, would the gentlemen please follow Mr. Johnson and the ladies stay with me?
It is immensely entertaining because you don't know where it's going to go next. Suddenly you're in a strip club.
For the scene in the strip club, The Beatles invited the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band to appear in a cameo role.
I do remember Viv being rather sort of miffed at the thought, you know, because Paul suggested he wore a kind of chiffony scarf to look more trendy. And I don't think Viv took kindly to that, but he did it.
Neil Innes of the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band.
Was racing through the night.
An attractive, dark-haired woman sashes on stage in a pink feather boa.
I think we related to them because they were mischievous and funny. But, I mean, we didn't care about show business particularly.
Curves can kill.
We had a lot of that kind of art school world in common, you know. We'd all seen the art movies, we'd all seen the certain paintings, we knew Magritte and things like that. And you know, when you're 20-somethings, you like them, so you want to sort of embrace them in a way and use them in things. And so, you know, if we had sort of like robots or masks or things like that, we offered them up as images.
Someone's gonna make you pay your fare.
On stage, the stripper, now down to her knickers, strokes the lead singer's face.
You pay your fare.
She swivels her hips and drapes the pink feather boa around her neck. Then the lead singer wraps his arms around her and the curtain falls on them.
We had no idea what the film was going to be like, but there was a kind of clue in the title, you know, Magical Mystery Tour. I think it's a clever title because you can pretty much do anything, you know.
The film playing on an old-fashioned TV set next to a Christmas tree.
I was sitting in front of my dad on the floor. He was sitting in the chair and I was like resting against the arm of the chair, and the stripper came on. And as it started to get more and more sort of risque, I suddenly found this hanky being draped across my eyes, which was quite embarrassing for me, because obviously I thought I was so grown up at 11 years old.
A Magical Mystery Tour. I think it was telling the older generation that the things were changing. That's how I felt, you know, that the old routines were going to change. I think probably my dad may have found it a bit scary.
The final destination of the tour was Newquay, Cornwall. A windswept expanse of beach, rolling waves, then the Part Magical Mystery Tour bus. A letter to the Daily Telegraph, 30th December 1967.
Sir, I am sorry that Mr. Norman Hare disliked Magical Mystery Tour. We are an elderly couple and had never seen or heard of the Beatles. The film entranced us and was all too short. I thought it a clever blend of all too real life and pure magic. They achieved the atmosphere of a coach tour perfectly. The surge of humanity from the coach at each stop. The sad wet sands of the inevitable dead low tide on West Country beaches. These and other points were cleverly heightened by the fantastic dream or nightmare sequences, also familiar to the coach tourer who has nodded off. The photography was imaginative and original, and I laughed till I cried several times. But I fear they will not make another film like it, and perhaps they had better not try. Yours faithfully, Anne Lee Michelle, Mrs. Milverton, Somerset.
The interior of an empty restaurant, then a man playing the violin. Nat Jackley, in a leopard print coat and flat cap, is trying to eat soup, but every time he goes to bring the spoon to his mouth, his companion at the dining table stops his hand.
I think that there is within them a kind of an English idea of subversion rather than the American idea of subversion of stone throwing and that sort of thing. So it's much subtler because England as itself is a very different place, observing it for the last 50 years as a foreigner and outsider. The way the English respond and change is quite different from the way other nations, they don't actually go at it head on.
A polished floor, genteel dining tables and chairs, then the exterior of a large old-fashioned hotel.
It's a sort of travelogue, it's a sort of documentary, it's a sort of slice of British working class life. It has so many goodies in it, but I can understand why establishment felt threatened by what the Beatles were doing, because, you know, if everybody grows their hair long, who's going to be in the army?
For me, it certainly still holds up. The imagery was created without CGI at a time when it was all photochemical, and some of it we may have gotten used to now. Now, of course, the emphasis on professionalism and polish and politeness is has come back now with a vengeance. It's expected, and there's a tendency to forget that it's really, that's only one choice, you know, one way of going.
I think it's brilliant. I think it's just a laugh. And I don't think it's just because of our memories. I think it's just a piece of film that would be enjoyable.
I don't care what the people think about it. I'm still proud to be part of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Back on the tour bus at night.
It's a charming acknowledgement and indeed perhaps a profession in a very positive way, of these are the people we are, and these are the people we've become, mixed together.
Ringo's watching film of the Beatles performing in White Tie and Tails on his laptop.
God, he's the worst dancer.
In a diagonal line, the four walk down a staircase in time to the music.
Yeah, your mother should know, the Dancing Boys. How great. Who choreographed that? I don't know if we did that or not, it looked too real for us. Because it was all, you know, I'd like to say I did, but I don't know.
Young women twirling around in taffeta evening dresses.
You can see that in some of the segments we'd had no idea. There's just a smiley face in number four. So that was like, we'll think of something fun.
The four Beatles salute.
And I think we thought that, you know, just to have an improvised film would give us a lot of freedom and would also show the kind of playfulness and the freedom that we were experiencing as the Beatles at that time. However, we realised we had to have something to show people. And when the cameraman would say, well, where do you want me to be? He'd say, on the coach in the morning, 9 o'clock. And we thought, well, that's enough information.
The Beatles prance about in their white tie and tails.
You know, you could argue, oh, well, the Beatles caught the bus, you know, but the Beatles didn't catch the bus, they were the bus.
Now the four of them are dressed as wizards in long orange cloaks with pointed hats.